Please be advised that this serving of AIDS, the Lost Voices, may cause offense or upset, as...
We read newspaper articles from the 1980s and 90s that shares detail around deaths caused by suicide. Anyone affected by these articles should reach out to the Samaritans Free on 116 123.
AIDS brings a response from the government.
AIDS, the disease which claims life.
Welcome to Extra Tea with your camp host, William Hampson.
And my fabulous co-host, Gloria.
Between us, we'll be looking back through the decades at how Britain reported on the AIDS pandemic.
And where we will try to unpick individual stories in the newspaper archives from the 80s, 90s and noughties.
Ready?
Ready.
All right, let's do it.
God, you're such a shady bitch.
Starting without me. But we're back.
Yes, we're back.
Hello, Gloria.
Hey, did you manage to put your feet up after series one?
No, quite the opposite. I haven't stopped. It's been 15-hour days. And at one point, I didn't leave the house once in 32 days.
Wow.
Because I was just researching the newspaper archive, individual stories, individual families, and tracing living relatives and messaging them. So really, I could have just given you a very short answer and just said no.
On that note, shall we get started?
Let's do it.
So, what's the first story we're looking at?
Well, I think it goes without saying that when you mention the word AIDS to someone, they're more than likely going to associate it with the word death. But what if I were to tell you that there are so many stories in the newspaper archives of people who died because of AIDS and not from AIDS?
Who died because of AIDS and not from AIDS?
Mm-hmm.
You'll have to explain, because I'm stumped.
Well, the headline from this first newspaper article that we're going to be looking at on the 3rd of April 1987 will perhaps explain.
Okay.
Because the Daily Post newspaper published a story with the headline, AIDS fears drove Lee, 18, to suicide.
18 years old?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, so young.
Incredibly young. And sadly, the article reads, an 18-year-old storeman hanged himself because he feared he had AIDS.
That is sad.
An inquest heard yesterday. But Lee Sands had nothing worse than suspected tonsillitis, the inquest was told.
Oh, this is incredibly sad.
Incredibly sad. And as many may recall, there was a fear around HIV and AIDS, whether it be a fear of those who were living with it and people fearing they'd catch it. Some say that the AIDS Don't Die of Ignorance campaign, you know, the Falling Tombstone, instilled such a fear that it questionably saved lives. But I think it has to be recognised, just by the newspaper archives alone, it's not scientific, but from what I saw, that 1986, 1987, you do see a spike of suicides being reported in the press from people who merely feared they had AIDS. And this seems to peter out around the early to mid-1990s.
Lee sadly took his own life on March 13th, 1987.
Sadly, yes. And at this time, we've got the AIDS Don't Die of Ignorance campaign underway with the Falling Tombstone TV advert. And just weeks prior to him taking his own life in February 1987, we have an AIDS Awareness Week, which sees the BBC One, BBC Two, ITV and Channel 4 continuously showing streams of programmes, of documentaries, information. It perhaps seems that this awareness, with good intention, also did provoke such fear in people that ultimately led them to take their own lives.
Does the article say what Lee feared, which led to him taking his own life?
Well, the article goes on to state, he committed suicide after his family and colleagues joked about the virus. They laughed when they heard that he had been sent for a blood test by his family doctor, who merely thought he might be suffering from glandular fever. The test proved negative and disclosed Lee was suffering from a bacterial infection thought to be tonsillitis. However, a day later he was found hanged from a ceiling beam at Maynard's Antique in Milton, Portsmouth, where he had worked for about a year. His employer's wife and his father both admitted joking about AIDS. In a statement to the Portsmouth inquest, Mr. Martin Sands said, quote, my son told me he had to go for a blood test and I joked with him about the AIDS virus. He laughed, but I think he may have been seriously worried about it.
For the article to select this specific quote from the statement, I hope that Mr. Sands didn't feel in any way responsible for his son taking his own life.
I hope so too, but I personally think that it's clear, given the stigma, the ignorance and the rhetoric of 1987, both known then and retrospectively looking back at documented accounts, that society as a whole, whether it be national or global, along with the press and media, surely contributed to Lee's thought process in regards to HIV and AIDS that eventually, sadly, sees him take his own life.
Yeah, good point.
And the article concludes, Lee of Alva Road, Fratton, Portsmouth, was known to have had several girlfriends. Coroner, Mr. John Glanville, recording a verdict of suicide, said, quote, "This is a very sad case. For some unknown reason, the young man thought that because he had been sent for a blood test, he had AIDS. He did not lead the style of life that would have given him any reason to fear he had the disease."
An incredibly sad story. I can't see how Lee's parents and siblings could ever come to terms with such a loss.
It seems incredibly sad from this article that it just seems to be a few off-the-cuff jokey comments fed into the fears and the stigma around HIV and AIDS. And I think you have to look back and say to yourself, well, actually, where did this all come from? And I can't help but say, and I've said it before, that, you know, 1987, the major source of information and the stigma and rhetoric around HIV AIDS seems to come from the national newspapers, comes from the press. The newspapers just seem to have free rein to say what they want, sensationalising stories, as many as we covered back in series one.
Yeah.
And on the anniversary of Lee's passing, on the 13th of March 2009, there was a notice placed in the Portsmouth News which reads, "Sans Lee, remembering our lovely son and brother, taken so tragically 22 years ago. Time will never heal the pain that we still and always feel. Loved and missed so very, very much. Mum, Mike, Nigel, Natasha, and all the family," followed by four kisses. "My lovely Lee."
And sadly, another young man by the name of Stephen Roberts also ended his life fearing he had an AIDS diagnosis.
Yes. This is the Herald Express for Torbay and Devon on the 17th of March 1988, went with the headline, "AIDS Fear Father Committed Suicide," and the article states, "A father took his own life in a fume-filled car at Torquay because he was frightened he had AIDS," an inquest has heard. Stephen Roberts, 23, wrongly thought he had caught the deadly disease from his teenage girlfriend and ended their relationship before he committed suicide. But a blood test after his death showed he was negative, and results of hospital tests on his girlfriend revealed she had only a relatively minor sexual infection. Torbay and South Devon coroner Mr. Hamish Turner said yesterday, and I quote, "This is a particularly unfortunate case for a young man of 23 years of age who possibly out of the prevalent amount of advertising thought that he may have contracted AIDS or his girlfriend had."
It seems the coroner is alluding to the Don't Die of Ignorance campaign that had been running from the previous year.
Exactly. You know, you've got the campaign, which has a TV advert that many said at the time and in recent years scared the wits out of them, to put it politely. But there's an irony here that a campaign that was intended to save lives seems only to be contributing to the fear around HIV AIDS and thus resulting in the loss of life, as we're seeing through these articles, of which this article goes on to state. But the young girl whom Mr. Roberts of Alpine Road, Torquay had planned to live with when she turned 18 had a comparatively minor sexual disease, added Mr. Turner. Mr. Roberts had been going through a divorce with his wife of 5 years and his two children had been taken into care. His mum, Mrs. Emily Roberts of Victoria Park Road, Paignton, told the inquest. His wife had left him for someone else and had not looked after the youngsters properly. But last November he met a 17-year-old and they were very happy together, said Mrs. Roberts. They planned to set up home when she became 18. But his happiness was to last just a few months. On January the 15th, he finished the relationship and told his mother his girlfriend might be suffering from AIDS. Mrs. Roberts said she thought that couldn't be the case, but he thought it was, and left at about 10 p.m, she said. It was the next day he was found in the fume-filled car.
Oh, no.
Mrs. Marlene Lowe, a part-time machinist of Cross Park, Collerton Road, Shipay, was walking her dog near the Drum Inn at Cockington when she heard a car engine running. She saw the blue Mini had a pipe attached to the exhaust, so pulled it off and opened the driver's door. She could smell exhaust fumes inside and switched off the engine before running to the Drum Inn to dial 999. Drum Inn manager Mr. Vincent Horsley and a friend went to the scene in Bewley Lane and lifted the man out of the car. They tried to revive him until the ambulance arrived, but it was no good. Mr. Roberts' father, William, was later called to the hospital to formally identify his son's body. PC Joe Satterthwaite said doctors found the cause of death was carbon monoxide poisoning, of which there was a high level of 93% in Mr. Roberts' blood. A test for the HIV virus proved negative. Mr. Roberts had mentioned to his doctor about his fears of AIDS, but there should have been no fear at all, said PC Saffelthwaite. Mr. Turner said it was extremely difficult to catch AIDS unless someone was extremely promiscuous or in a high-risk group, and Mr. Roberts was in no such danger. He recorded a verdict that Mr. Roberts had taken his own life, adding it was probably due to misapprehension.
This was followed by an obituary placed in the Torbay and Devon Express on January 21st, 1988, which read, Stephen Roberts, aged 23, tragically passed away on Saturday, January 16th. Loving son of Bill and Emily, much loved brother of Billy, Dawn, and Marie. Sadly missed.
Oh, do you know, just incredibly sad.
When life is difficult, the Samaritans are available day or night, 365 days a year. You can call them free on 116 123. Alternatively, you can email them at joe@samaritans.org or visit www.samaritans.org to find your nearest branch.
And this next story was reported in the Wolverhampton Express on the 13th of August 1986 with the headline, Teachers Tragic, I've Got AIDS Warning. Headline aside, what is incredibly striking is under the front page headline is a photograph of two men in hazmat suits loading a wooden coffin into the back of a vehicle.
It's one thing to publish this kind of photo inside the newspaper, but to put it on the front page.
It's very sensationalist, isn't it? Even for people that are not reading the newspaper, that are just going to see the newspaper on the newspaper stand at the newsagent's or at the train station, are going to be hit with this image. It's very undignified.
I agree.
And the article states, a Walsall teacher found slumped over his bath with slashed wrists left a note warning that he had AIDS, an inquest heard this afternoon. The note was pinned to a door at the home of Mr. John Hutchinson, reading, Don't revive AIDS. Coroner Mr. Aidan Cotter is now considering whether to risk ordering a post-mortem on Mr. Hutchinson.
This is very sad to hear. But I can't help but wonder if the coroner's hesitation to order a post-mortem isn't that John's manner of death is perhaps obvious, but more the fact he considers AIDS to be a risk.
Yes, because we saw this in the first series with Stuart Thompson Neal when Dr. Simpson refused to carry out a post-mortem, assuming AIDS was a risk, although Stuart wasn't believed to have passed away due to AIDS or an AIDS-related illness. But if you remember at the time, they stated that hepatitis B was a greater risk during a post-mortem, and the article goes on to state, he is also believed to have been suffering from hepatitis B, a virus which attacks the liver.
Okay, but didn't we learn that a post-mortem could still go ahead, as with both HIV/AIDS and hepatitis pathologists and staff could protect themselves with PPE?
Exactly, but I think we need to remember this is 1986.
Okay.
And I remember stating in the story we covered about Stuart Thompson Neal in Series 1 that Professor Simpson didn't set a precedent, which in large he didn't.
Yeah.
And by that I mean, if anybody hasn't listened to the episode, that he was refusing to carry out a post-mortem on this young man, Stuart Thompson Neal, merely applying the suspicion that he might have AIDS, which he didn't. However, you have to remember that the attitudes around HIV and AIDS in regards to pathologists at this time is in itself endemic. I remember in that episode, all the relevant national bodies, such as the Coroner's Association, stated around 1985, the time of Stuart Thompson Neal, that there was absolutely no risk to pathologists or mortuary staff with a deceased body that either had HIV/AIDS or the suspicion of HIV/AIDS if they all wore the correct PPE. It's as simple as that.
Exactly.
And the article continues, the body of Mr. Hutchinson, a teacher at Queen Mary's Grammar School, was found at his home in Bernard Street, Walsall, yesterday. Inspector Hickman, of Walsall Police, said at the inquest that the note also warned would-be rescuers to contact a doctor. Inspector Hickman said, quote, from inquiries we have made, it does seem probable that Mr. Hutchinson was suffering from AIDS. Mr. Hutchinson had been identified by a brother from a police photograph of the body. The inquest was adjourned. Friends who called at Mr. Hutchinson's found him dead in the bathroom. Police and medical staff wearing full protective clothing were called to the scene after being told that Mr. Hutchinson, age 48, was believed to be suffering from a highly infectious disease. The body was sealed in plastic bags before being put into a coffin and taken from the terraced house.
And under the photograph of Mr. Hutchinson's coffin being removed from his home, there's a separate headline that reads, Defense Against a Killer. The side article shares hepatitis B is an infectious disease, but at the top of this story, they state, "The dramatic picture highlights the precautions taken in dealing with suspected AIDS sufferers. Four men, police and medical staff, wore protective overalls and masks to remove the body of Mr. Hutchinson from his home. Their feet were protected by special shoes."
I'd want to say that this is incredible overkill.
I agree.
I mean, it's 1986 and the routes of transmission were well known for HIV and AIDS.
Uh-huh.
Hepatitis B was also around way before HIV and AIDS, and the routes of transmission for that were also known. I think given the manner in which Mr. Hutchinson was found, with open wounds and no doubt blood present, that I think they are right to protect themselves, but I can't help but feel once the body is, as they described, placed in a bag and then placed in the coffin,
yeah,
the element of danger, if any, is incredibly low. I mean, there is probably more danger in the photograph given the message it sends out to an already panicked and hysterical and ignorant public. Mm. And this part of the article you're talking about continues. Hepatitis B, from which Mr. Hutchinson was also believed to be suffering, is a severe feverish disease which attacks the liver and kills about 150 people every year in Britain. Hospital doctors, nurses and dentists are particularly at risk. Only 2 months ago, scientists at Birmingham University launched a nationwide study to assess disease risks, including hepatitis, faced by pathologists and mortuary staff. Hepatitis B is transmitted by contaminated blood transfusions or by the use of contaminated syringes or needles, particularly by drug addicts and tattooists. Infected people may carry the virus in their blood for many years so that they become carriers.
What is refreshing is John's neighbors share their sadness on learning of his passing and his HIV status.
Yes, across various articles, but in this one particularly, it states, "Shocked neighbors said today that they had no idea Mr. Hutchinson had been seriously ill. Quote, he was like a son to me and always helping me out, said Mrs. Ada Williams, who lives next door. Queen Mary's headmaster, Mr. Keith Howard, said news of Mr. Hutchinson's death had come as a great shock. Quote, he was a very able and dedicated man. The school was his whole life. He did an enormous amount of work for the Parents Association, the School Fete Committee and many other school groups." Now, John's death was determined to have occurred the day before this article, with his date of death being the 12th of August 1986, the day that he was found.
And the day after this article, John's death makes the national newspapers.
That's right, the tabloids are never one to miss a story. But on the 14th of August 1986, the Daily Mirror reported much of the previous article that we've just read, along with, quote, "Mr. Hutchinson, a grammar school French master, was probably also suffering from deadly hepatitis B, which is 100 times more infectious than AIDS."
You're not praising them, are you?
No. But for a tabloid, it's refreshing they're highlighting scientific facts as opposed to jumping on the AIDS bandwagon. Although I do see that this is what they are doing, you know, with phrases like the deadly hepatitis B, you know, they are jumping on it. But it is quite refreshing that they're kind of taking a step back from AIDS and highlighting the facts around hepatitis B. It is 100 times more infectious than AIDS. But on the same day, it was the Wolverhampton Express that reported the coroner had ruled that no post-mortem was to take place.
Really?
The article quotes Mr. Cotter, the coroner, "The body has been examined visually by a consultant pathologist acting on my instructions and by the senior police officer involved in the case. Both the family and the police have told me that they do not require a post-mortem. I personally am satisfied that the value of any further information which could be obtained from a post-mortem does not justify the risks of infection which could be involved."
The coroner is really saying there are no questions as to the cause of death.
Exactly. They've visually inspected the body to rule out any foul play or any other cause of death. And I think sometimes people think death certificates are for listing all of a person's ailments, perhaps even ailments the person was unaware of, established from an internal examination. But the death certificate is merely to document what caused the person's death. And in John's case, sadly, as we've heard from the articles, it's clear how he died.
But was it confirmed John had a diagnosis of HIV or hepatitis?
Well, the article goes on to state, "Mr. Hutchinson had been to a clinic in the Wolverhampton area where tests reveal he had AIDS. At the inquest opening yesterday, the coroner heard of the discovery of the body and the warning note.
Okay.
Today, Mr. Hutchinson's neighbours in Bernard Street were shocked at the news. Mrs. Janet Reynolds said, "No one is unduly worried or panicking. He was a man who kept himself to himself, but he was well liked and always gave money when collections went around. We are hoping to make a collection for him and give the money to charity."
I have to say, this is not the response I was expecting. I don't mean in regard to John's good character, but give the usual prejudice and stigma around HIV/AIDS in 1986.
Me neither. And it doesn't end there, because we hear from another neighbour, where the article states, "Mother of two, Mrs. Sean Brace, said, quote, 'We all feel that it was very tragic and sad. The fact that he had AIDS and another illness does not worry me.'"
Awesome.
At the 650 pupil school where Mr. Hutchinson had taught for 20 years, six formers were today arriving to collect exam results. Neil Fogarty, aged 18, of York Road, Rushall, who has just left school, said, "He was a very good teacher who could have a laugh and laugh at himself. We have all been shocked at this, and that he should take his own life in such a way."
John's popularity from the testimony of his neighbours, close friends and pupils makes an already sad story even sadder.
I know, right? And, you know, you've got the neighbours that are saying nice things because he's a nice guy, you know, clearly.
Yeah, I thought
some
that.
Some say that he keeps himself to himself. Others say that he gives to charity when collections come round. He's got his elderly neighbour next door saying that he runs errands for her.
Yeah.
You've got school pupils that are saying nice things, which is quite unusual, really, actually, because I think we've all got, you know, many teachers that we didn't like at school, but we've probably all got that one teacher that we really liked and admired.
Yeah.
And John seems to be that teacher. However, I'm afraid the events shared in this article don't get any better, as the article concludes.
Oh, no.
"Police officers and civilians," there was five in total, "who recovered the body are still awaiting the results of blood tests being carried out at a Birmingham laboratory."
Oh, man.
Chief Inspector Alan Wilkes said they were satisfied that no one had been at risk, but the tests were to make sure no one had hepatitis B antibodies in their blood. "Health experts are deciding today how to set about the task of decontaminating the house where Mr. Hutchinson died."
This irrational fear of infection sounds very similar to the Paul Soames episode in Series 1.
Oh, do you know, it's just exhausting, but you're right, because here we have five personnel who have overalls, rubber boots, gloves, masks, and visors, as we quite clearly see in the press photos and the descriptions that are given in the articles, feel they also have to take the extra measure of taking a test, a blood test, which seems to be an incredible overreaction, given the routes of transmission for both hepatitis B and HIV/AIDS. And as for the mention of the decontaminating of the house, this story rumbles on for the next few days.
Really?
And do you remember we looked at the Public Health Control of Diseases Act in the Roger Ude episode?
Oh, no. Go on.
Well, it's mentioned again in the Wolverhampton Express on the 15th of August, 1986, under the headline, "Cleaners Check Deaf House Before Spraying."
No way.
And the article reads, "Council cleaners in full protective gear were today moving in to disinfect the house of Walsall AIDS victim John Hutchinson. Under the Public Health Control of Disease Act, a notice had to be posted on the front door of the Bernard Street house yesterday, giving 24 hours notice of the operation."
I understand there is a procedure, but this all sounds OTT to me.
Oh, do you know, it's just exhausting, but I'm inclined to agree with you. You'd expect that they'd want to go in on the lowdown to avoid any public hysteria.
Yeah.
I don't get the impression that they're trying to, you know, humiliate or desecrate John's memory in any way whatsoever. I think they're being very procedural about it, perhaps for the local street and the local community to let people know that, look, this has happened. It's been widely reported quite graphically in the press. We are going in and we're going to ensure that the operation of cleaning up the house does get done. And I suppose it really kind of quashes any of those rumours or local legends that I remember as a kid on my street. You know, if there was a rundown house or an overgrown bush, don't go in that house because, you know, there's an old lady lives in there and she eats kids, and there's an old man that lives in that house and he eats the paper boy, and, you know, things like this. And you used to walk past shit scared for years. And I suppose this really shuts down any, you know, any new tenants that go into the house, or any buyers that buy the house that, oh, that's the AIDS house, and, you know, talking about the cleanup situation and stuff. I suppose it kind of stops any of that from manifesting. So the notice goes up on the front door. The next day, the 16th of August 1986, the Wolverhampton Express states, disinfectant was sprayed around the terrace building to kill off traces of the killer virus hepatitis B, from which Mr. Hutchinson was also believed to be suffering. Mr. Hutchinson, a 48-year-old French master from Queen Mary's Grammar School, was found dead with his wrist slashed at the house on Tuesday. He had left a note warning that he had AIDS. Wolverhampton Council backed up Walsall officials by lending specialist equipment for the clean-up job. Councillor Malcolm Barton, chairman of Walsall's Environmental Health Committee, said, quote, "The staff who went into the house did so on a voluntary basis, and I am satisfied everything has been done correctly. The house is to remain sealed for a few days while a decision is taken on the removal of any contents."
For the benefit of the listeners, I'm rolling my eyes.
6 days after John's passing, he is cremated in a small intimate ceremony, and the Wolverhampton Express reports the story the day after on the 19th of August 1986, and the headline reads, "AIDS victim is cremated at private service." And the article reads, "A single cross of flowers lay on the coffin of Walsall AIDS victim Mr. John Hutchinson, a 48-year-old teacher, as it was carried into the chapel at Streatley Crematorium for his funeral. A group of about 18 relatives and close friends attended the ceremony yesterday. The private service had been requested by the French teacher's family, and the cross of white chrysanthemums, carnations and red roses was the only floral tribute. It bore a card with the message, quote, 'Always remembered from all the family.' Mourners filed into the crematorium chapel as the hearse carrying Mr. Hutchinson arrived for the cremation. Four members of the funeral director's staff placed the flowers on the coffin and then carried it into the chapel. The service was over in less than 15 minutes. Mr. Hutchinson, who taught at Queen Mary's Grammar School, Walsall, for 20 years, was found dead at his home in Bernard Street, Walsall, last week. His wrists were slashed and he had left a note warning that he had AIDS. A full inquest is due to be held within the next few weeks."
And the inquest opened on September 29th, 1986.
That's right. And it's the Wolverhampton Express on the day of the inquest, the 29th of September, that reports the testimony given by John's friend who arrives at the house on the day John is discovered. And under the headline, "Friend says AIDS man preoccupied," the article states, "Walsall AIDS victim John Hutchinson had seemed very withdrawn and preoccupied before his death, an old friend of Mr. Hutchinson's told an inquest this afternoon. Mr. Keith Vaughan of Churchill Wensbury told how he last saw his friend 4 days before Mr. Hutchinson's body was found, slumped over a bath with slashed wrists. They arranged to meet on August the 12th, but when Mr. Vaughan went round to Mr. Hutchinson's house in Bernard Street, Walsall, he could get no reply. Mr. Vaughan said he had known Mr. Hutchinson, a 48-year-old French teacher at Queen Mary's Grammar School for 20 years, and that he had not seemed himself when he last saw him. Quote, 'He seemed very withdrawn and very preoccupied and seemed not at all well,' added Mr. Vaughan. Mr. Vaughan said he had tried to call Mr. Hutchinson after they had arranged to meet, but the telephone had been engaged or there was no reply. When he arrived at the house on August the 12th, Mr. Vaughan heard water splashing inside. He telephoned his neighbour in Wensbury, Mr. Donald Griffiths, who came over and they both let themselves into the house with a neighbour's key. Mr. Griffiths said they saw water cascading from the living room ceiling and decided to call the police without looking any further. PC David Cross, the first police officer on scene, said he went into the house and after seeing the water went upstairs, where he saw a sign saying, 'Danger, AIDS virus, do not revive.' PC Cross said he saw Mr. Hutchinson's body on the floor of the bathroom." The inquest continues.
John's friend Keith says John seemed very withdrawn, very preoccupied, 4 days prior to him finding John's body.
Mm.
Does the inquest learn why John was perhaps feeling this way?
I think the testimony from John's GP perhaps answers this question when the inquest is reported in the Wolverhampton Express on the 30th of September 1986. And the article states, "Dr. Austin Moore of Lisway Street, Walsall, the dead man's GP, said Mr. Hutchinson had strongly suspected he had AIDS, but it was not confirmed until the day of his death.
So John wasn't aware he was HIV/AIDS positive until they tested him after his death?
Not quite, because it was confirmed at the inquest, and I quote, Dr. Taha Wanas, a consultant at the Royal Hospital, Wolverhampton, who had carried out tests on Mr. Hutchinson and was due to see him on the day of his death to confirm AIDS.
So John's suspicions were correct, despite not learning of his recent test results.
Yes. And, you know, it's not uncommon. You know, many stories that I've seen and heard, and I know in this episode we're going to be hearing from somebody directly that says they didn't need to be told the results that they were HIV/AIDS positive. They already knew. And I think perhaps this is the case here with John. You know, he's gone for the test to confirm something that perhaps he already knew.
That is sad.
But the coroner, Mr. Aidan Cotter, was very vocal in this case, even calling it, quote, immoral that people living with HIV/AIDS had a right of confidentiality between patient and doctor when it came to an AIDS diagnosis. He argues at length in the 30th of September 1986 article that emergency services and pathologists should be able to access a patient's status to protect themselves.
That's awful.
And the coroner, Aidan Cotter, alludes to John's death when raising his concerns or issues around doctor and patient confidentiality when it comes to a HIV/AIDS diagnosis to Thames Television. So let's take a listen.
Recently, a Midlands coroner had to deal with a practical crisis involving an AIDS patient.
A local man who believed he got AIDS killed himself. He killed himself in a way which left a great deal of blood lying around. When the police and the medical attendants and my officer attended the scene, they could easily have come into contact with the blood. And I believe, from doctors that I've spoken to, that you can catch AIDS through the blood of an infected victim if you have an open wound. And what the medical people call an open wound need be no more than a slight graze or a pulled quick on your finger. All I'm asking is that the records which the hospital already keep ought to be open to the police or to the coroner's office so that when somebody dies, the police or the coroner can ring the hospital and simply ask, has this particular person got AIDS? And they answer yes or no.
And back in the newspaper article, we hear from the coroner, Dr. Aidan Cotter, who we've just heard from there, where the article states, summing up, Mr. Cotter said it was clear Mr. Hutchinson knew or suspected he had AIDS and decided to take his own life. Mr. Hutchinson was respected in this town as a man who was always thoughtful and responsible, and even when preparing to take his own life, was sufficiently thoughtful to leave a note, he said. Quote, if he had not left it, the police, medical staff, my own staff, doctors, pathology, and mortuary personnel would have all been at risk. I accept the medical evidence that the risk is small, but where the result is likely to be death, I would have thought that the fewer mistakes that are made, the better. I do not criticise any of the doctors in this case or suggest anyone did anything wrong. I propose to forward these papers to the Minister of Health and ask him to consider whether it is right that this information is kept secret, even from hospitals and pathologists. He said he was not suggesting the facts should be made public, but there must be a way for police and others to check and find the information in emergencies.
Incredibly sad. Correct me if I'm wrong, but wouldn't it be easier for all the personnel he listed to approach every scenario with relevant PPE to protect themselves and others?
Absolutely. And it's always stated with arguments like this that it's all well and good knowing someone has HIV/AIDS or hepatitis to take the relevant precautions to protect yourselves. But why wouldn't you take the same precautions to protect yourselves when dealing with people who don't know the HIV or hepatitis status? I mean, for example, do dentists only sterilise their equipment properly if they know they've used it on someone with HIV? I mean, my worry as a dentist would be the people that don't know their HIV/AIDS status. Does a tattooist only discard its needles when tattooing someone with hepatitis, say? But I think this is slowly drip-fed through to emergency services that perhaps respond to situations, because you're quite often, when you see police running to a scene or going somewhere, especially in London, I always see them either putting on a pair of blue gloves, blue latex gloves, or they've already got the gloves on. because they don't know what they're going to. And I, you know, for the last 20 odd years, I've done a first aid course every 3 years, and it's a 3 day course. And they always mention like little tips and tricks, and they'd say, oh, you know, get a Kinder Egg, and you can put a pair of gloves in there, and you can keep it in your pocket, or you can keep it in your first aid bum bag. Because if you ever get a call to go to a first aid situation, the first thing you should be thinking about is protecting yourselves by putting the gloves on as you're going. And then when you get there, you're ready, because you don't know what you're going to.
This is what I mean.
Well, despite the coroner, Dr. Aidan Cotter, making such a fuss and many headlines in the newspapers, all of which are on the blog post associated with this episode, the very next day, the British Medical Association responded to the coroner's request, where in the Wolverhampton Express on the 30th of September 1986, under the headline, "Name Victim's Plea is Rejected," the article states, "The British Medical Association today rejected a call from a Walsall coroner for the naming of AIDS victims to police, hospitals and other people at risk. Mr. Aidan Cotter made the request at the inquest of AIDS sufferer Mr. John Hutchinson, who left a warning note to would-be rescuers. Mr. Cotter said that if he had not left the note, many people dealing with his case would not have been protected. But a spokesman for the British Medical Association said the medical confidentiality of AIDS victims could not be breached because of the damaging effects it would have in preventing sufferers coming forward for treatment." And the British Medical Association is quoted in the article as saying, "Confidentiality is of the utmost importance, and it must be kept if we are to encourage patients to come forward. Instead, we believe that safeguards should be taken by anyone dealing with a dead body, not only because of AIDS, but any number of infectious diseases."
All of the actual newspaper articles mentioned in this serving are available on the Extra Tea blog. You can find the link below in the show notes. If you've enjoyed listening to AIDS, The Lost Voices, then don't be a shady bitch and show us some love with
a big fat like,
a comment,
a share,
as in the link, not as in
do you believe in life after love, oh.
And for fuck's sake, don't forget to
subscribe and follow.
When life is difficult, the Samaritans are available day or night, 365 days a year. You can call them free on 116 123. Alternatively, you can email them at joe@samaritans.org or visit www.samaritans.org to find your nearest branch.